I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, for the first time, female boxers are competing to make an Olympic team. But first, an ambitious critique of the NCAA by Taylor Branch in the Atlantic Monthly was perhaps the most literate attack on the association. But objections to the way the NCAA does business have also come from other directions. Brian Porto, associate professor at Vermont Law School, has addressed that circumstance with a new book titled The Supreme Court and the NCAA, The Case for Less Commercialism and More Due Process in College Sports. Professor Porto, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you.
You start with the idea that the grafting of sports for profit onto academic institutions has never gone smoothly, but you maintain that two Supreme Court decisions in the 1980s made worse what was already bad. How did the Supreme Court come to be involved with the NCAA?
Well, the first instance was in 1984 when the University of Georgia and the University of Oklahoma sued the NCAA over its football television plan by which it regulated the televising of college football, limiting the number of games that could be televised, limiting the number of times any individual school could participate. So that was the first instance. The second instance was just a few years later, interestingly enough. It involved the efforts by the NCAA to ban from college sports a gentleman named Jerry Tarkanian, who was the highly successful but terribly controversial coach of the men's basketball team at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And the issue there was whether in the course of trying to discipline Tarkanian, the NCAA had denied him due process. The Supreme Court ruled that the NCAA was not a state actor. It wasn't governed by the requirements of the 14th Amendment. So the long and the short of it was the NCAA didn't have to provide Jerry Tarkanian or anybody else with due process.
Let's start with the first case. When the Supreme Court ruled in NCAA versus Regents that the NCAA could not restrict colleges from making their own TV deals, the court, you write, gave professionalism of college sports a big assist. How so?
The benefits of the football television plan were that there was an opportunity for smaller schools to participate, and the payout was the same regardless of the size or fame of the school. And so there weren't at that time great financial incentives to boost your athletic program to a point where it would appear many times on television. But in the wake of the Regents decision, the market opened up. At the same time that the NCAA decision came down, the cable television networks were just exploding in this country.
Your contention is that now it's up to Congress to change the conditions under which the business of college sports operates. What would you hope to see new laws achieve?
The bill that I have proposed would exempt the NCAA from the antitrust laws to the extent that it enacted measures that were designed to promote education for college athletes and limit commercialism. For example, ending Thursday night college football games, requiring that college basketball games on weeknights not start later than 7:30 in the evening. Limiting coaches' salaries to no more than 90% of what the university president makes. I mean, you could think of any number of these things. If it engaged in activities that were purely commercial, and if the plaintiff in a lawsuit against it could demonstrate that, then the NCAA would have to defend the rule and show that it really was educational, and it would be up to the court to determine.
You know, some of our listeners are going to hear this and they're going to say, this guy wants to give the NCAA more power. This is a bunch of greed-addled hypocrites. How can that be a good idea?
Yeah, that's a reasonable first blush sort of statement, I suppose. But I think the more you look at it, the more you realize that even if we were to get rid of the NCAA, we would have to replace it with something fairly similar. And somebody has to be involved in regulating college sports because the incentives to cheat are just too great not to have a regulatory authority.
You write that institutions, quote, probably cannot avoid the charge that they are exploiting athletes by not paying them. Doesn't this suggest that even new laws would only give rise to new, more devious strategies by athletic departments?
While that potential certainly is always there, I think we can do a lot to counter that charge. There are a couple of ways in which we could go. We could certainly go in the direction that a number of people, including Taylor Branch, have recommended, and that is let's just pay the athletes. But who do you pay? Do you pay you have to pay the women athletes too? Do you only pay the athletes whose teams make a profit? I think the better way to go has been suggested by Scott Cowan, who is the president of Tulane University, move in the direction of reducing the amount of time the athletes have to devote to their sports, giving them more time to be university students, more time to do internships, look for a job, the same thing that other students get to do. And also, let's make the scholarship pay the full cost of attendance. I'm all in favor of that.
Plenty of fans who probably don't care about such things as graduation rates like their D1 college football and basketball just as it is, which is why there is so much TV money involved. Where is the incentive in Congress to tamper with this large and growing industry?
There have been many schools that have been caught in the NCAA's net. And so typically, if you look back at the history of congressional investigations of the NCAA, you will see that they tend to be investigations of the NCAA's disciplinary process. So I think there's plenty of incentive there, and it's a bipartisan incentive. There's not a whole lot of bipartisanship in Washington these days, but I think there's plenty of incentive because of the fear that your favorite school will get caught in the disciplinary process and be mistreated if nothing happens. Now, I have to recognize that historically the Congress has preferred to let the NCAA resolve its own problems, and it has used the hearings as sort of a way to nudge the NCAA. My argument is the nudging hasn't worked very well, and we need to go beyond that to legislation.
Brian Porto, associate professor at Vermont Law School, is the author of The Supreme Court and the NCAA, The Case for Less Commercialism and More Due Process in College Sports. It's published by the University of Michigan Press. Professor Porto, thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.